Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, we discuss memory. The human brain is so fascinating, and understanding how we think, remember, and act is a complex process. We think of memory as a single thing, but as we will learn today, it is in fact composed of several distinct systems, each associated with a particular brain network. And joining us is Dr. Andrew Budson, Chief of Cognitive and Behavioral Neurology at the Veterans Affairs Boston Healthcare System and Professor of Neurology at Boston University. Welcome.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Elizabeth Kinsinger is the professor and chair of the Department of Psychology and Neuroscience at Boston College. Welcome to you as well, Elizabeth.
Thank you so much.
And both are authors of Why We Forget and How to Remember Better, The Science Behind Memory. You start the book talking about what we've learned from Henri Molaison, better known as HM, and we see him in a lot of memory research. Elizabeth, you conducted research with HM. So for folks who aren't familiar with him, tell us a little bit more about HM.
So he was a man who in the 1950s had an experimental surgery to hopefully cure him of his epilepsy, which was very severe and was interfering with his ability to function in day-to-day life. He was a young man at that time. And the surgery was a success from that medical standpoint in terms of it greatly reducing the frequency and severity of the seizures that he was having. But it had a really severe and unintended consequence, which was that since that operation, he was actually never able to form a new long-term memory to which he had conscious access. So everything that happened to him from the time that he was a young man in his 20s up until he passed as an old man, he did not have any conscious recollection of any of those life experiences. But what was fascinating and what we'll talk more about this morning is that there was some evidence that he was able to learn new information over that time. It just wasn't information that he had conscious access to. And so this really ushered in the understanding of human memory as having these different systems, these different abilities that didn't all rely on the same brain structures. And so it really revolutionized the way that scientists started to think about memory and the types of experiments that were designed subsequently to understand its neural basis.
And one of the kind of aha moments is about the locked door, which wasn't even like really part of the research. It just kind of happened. So tell us about this locked door and the significance.
Yeah, so this was an experience that I had with Henri when I was a graduate student and had the opportunity to meet him. And it really is an example of this distinction between the types of memory abilities that were impaired and the types of memory abilities that he retained. And so this experience was that we would do test sessions with him on the MIT campus. And when there was inclement weather, especially, there's a set of underground tunnels that you can take that is a kind of a complicated maze to get you from one building to the next. And so presumably over the years, many different researchers had taken him in these underground corridors to get from one building to the next. And at one point you come to a door that, at least to me, had a very complicated lock mechanism that you had to undo in order to be able to get the doors open to be able to pass through. And so I was taking him down this corridor for the first time. Again, it was not his first time down these corridors, as there were many researchers before me that had taken him down this path. And so I got to the door and was fumbling with the lock. And Henri simply came forward and correctly did the set of adjustments on the lock and opened the door. And so again, this was not a scientific experiment, but I think it was a really fantastic demonstration of that fact that, you know, if you asked him, have you ever been down this corridor before? He would have said no. If you asked him, have you ever been on the MIT campus before? He would have said no. He had no conscious memories of any of those past experiences. But clearly there was something that he didn't have conscious access to that was actually allowing him to correctly perform those procedures that he had presumably seen many, many people before me correctly perform. Maybe he had performed them for other people as well, for all as I know. So I think it's that really remarkable distinction of the fact that so much happens to us that slips from our conscious awareness, but it continues to influence our behavior in these really powerful ways and allows us to respond to the environment in really adaptive ways, even if we don't have conscious access to what's happened that allows us to behave in that way.
So amazing. And so Andrew, it kind of speaks, is that muscle memory or procedural memory? What do you think was happening there?
Well, in that case, I think it was a procedural memory where, you know, the same memory you use if you're riding a bicycle or if you're, you know, typing away on your phone, you know, using your thumbs or typing on a computer keyboard without, you know, paying any attention to which fingers are actually pushing which keys. And that is not only preserved in individuals like Henry, who had their hippocampi removed, but it's also relatively preserved in most early damage due to Alzheimer's disease as well. So a lot of our individuals out there who have early Alzheimer's disease and may not be able to remember what's happening from one day to the next consciously can still use and learn new procedures and habits.
So let's talk about some of the different types of memory. So working memory, what is working memory?
So working memory is our ability to keep information online and manipulate it. So the classic example is if you are holding a phone number in your head by repeating it out loud to yourself, or, you know, you're going to place a takeout order from five of your friends and you're sort of repeating it over and over so that you don't forget them. That's one time you're using your working memory. Another time that you're using it is, you know, let's say you're driving home from work, a way you've done a million times and you're not thinking about it, but now there's a traffic jam or a detour and you have to think in your mind, okay, what are other routes that I should be able to take to avoid this bottleneck? That would be another example of using your working memory.
Episodic memory.
Well, episodic memory is memory for episodes of our life. It's our autobiographical memory. And that is what Henry had trouble with after his operation. It's the memory that we use to remember what we had for dinner the day before. It's also the memory that we use to remember, you know, the last birthday party that we had, and everything in between.
And there's something in that chapter called Ribot's Law. What is
Ribot's
Law? Okay.
Yeah. So Ribot noticed way back in the 1880s that there's this pattern of memory loss that he observed whether an individual had, for example, a traumatic brain injury, or they had the onset of Alzheimer's disease. And what he noticed is that from the onset of that injury, the individuals had difficulty in remembering new information, just like Henry. But in addition, they also lost somewhere between 6 months to 2 years of previously learned information. And they would lose a little bit more depending upon how severe the injury to the memory was. But most interestingly, there's also some preserved remote memory as well, just like how Henry could still remember some things from his childhood. Is that correct, Elizabeth?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the fascinating things that we've come to realize over the years of scientific experimentation is that often those remote memories have become what we'll talk about in a moment, semanticized, and have really become part of the stories that we're able to recount about our past. And so they're a little different in their qualities from kind of true episodic memories, but that also allows even people that have pretty severe impairments in episodic memory to still have access to these memories from a long time ago.
Mm. And we're talking about these different types of memory, and goes to different parts of the brain, and you get into more detail in the book about that. One of the things I thought was interesting, and I have heard this, but we all like to think that we can multitask and just do all these things. And you can't, right? You cannot really focus on more than as much as if you were focusing on one thing at a time. So this is a myth that we can do a good job at multitasking.
So true. It, you know, we, I know, especially, you know, I look at some of the students that I work with, and I'm sure Elizabeth finds the same thing. They try to multitask all the time, but they just can't do two things as well as they can do one thing at a time.
Right. And so you mentioned semantic memory. So let's talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so semantic memory is our memory for sort of facts and knowledge that's not related to a specific episode of your life. So if you think about the vocabulary words that you learned of a foreign language, or if you think about what color a lion is, or what a fork is used for, what temperature water boils at, who Harriet Tubman is, all of those things are facts and knowledge that you have in your memory stores, but they're not related to a specific episode of your life. And once they become these individual facts, we call it semantic memory. And we do think that it is actually stored and processed in the brain in a slightly different way than episodic memory.
I think we also think of our memories as like this big filing cabinet in our brains, right? We just kind of flip through. So where are these memories stored? They're in different places in our brain, right?
So I think that is one of the most erroneous metaphors that most of us do use to think of our memories, is that there's something that sits somewhere just waiting to be reaccessed. And I think it's so important that we recognize that memory is always an active process. It's an active process of creating new connections across the brain as we're experiencing an event. But then it's also an active process of recreating those connections across the brain as we're retrieving that event and bringing it back to mind again, especially when we're talking about those episodic memories, those specific events from our past. Mm-hmm. And so there's the region, the hippocampus, which was the region that was removed in Henry, that serves as the tape that helps all of these different regions stay connected while you're experiencing an event and then later as you're rebuilding the memory. But you also actually have to re-engage at that moment of retrieval all of the regions that were responsible for initially processing the sights of the event, the sounds of the event, the smells, the emotions that you were experiencing. Any of those details that are coming back to mind are coming back to mind not only because the hippocampus is re-engaged, but because the hippocampus has helped to reconnect all of those other regions of the brain as well. And that's really what gives us that sense that we've kind of traveled back in time. And in some sense, we are re-experiencing this past moment. The brain really is back in a state somewhat similar to the state that it was in as that event was first lived.
You said something really important there. We recreate them, right? So let's move on to collective memory. And here you write, sometimes the narratives you share with others can blur the lines between what is a memory of your own personal past and what is a memory another has shared with you. Disputes over what happened to whom are relatively common among siblings, especially among twins. We've all had this happen, right? Where you remember something and your sibling says, no, that's not the way it happened, right?
Absolutely. I think disagreements in memory are the norm, right? They're not the exception to the rule. They are the rule. And one of the reasons for that is this idea of our memories, of course, existing in our own brains and in that sense being our memories, but they also exist in a broader social context. They exist in the context of the culture that we live in. They exist in the context of the relationships that we have and how those relationships change over time. And so this is this concept of collective memory, which we thought it was really important to couch our, you know, what's happening in our brain in this larger social structure, because of course humans are highly social beings, and there's a lot of reason to think that a lot of what the human brain does really evolved to optimize our ability to interact socially with one another. And so I think the examples that you just gave are so prominent, where we think maybe something happened to us, but then we realize actually it happened to a friend, and we've just heard that story so much that we've imagined it, and now we've confused that imagination for something that happened to us. again, the literature suggests that with twins, especially identical twins, this happens even more, because whether they're imagining themselves or their twin, there could be a similarity in even who they're imagining this event happening to. So it's, you know, it's fascinating to think that some of the things that we hold as our own experiences may actually be someone else's, or in other cases may be really influenced by the way that they have told us that something unfolded, or the interpretation that they've given to an event that we've experienced.
And I think we think of our memories as this, like a photo, a snapshot in time, and that's not what they are at all. So you can see people like could get really confused of, wait a minute, what do you mean I wasn't there? I remember it. I'm sure I was. And we are so sure that that memory is ours. So what's happening in our brains there? Is it just that, like you say, we've heard that story so many times that we've created instead of recreated?
Yeah. So, we talk in the book about memory as being a set of building blocks that you have to be reassembling every time that you're retrieving the memory. And so if you think about it that way, if you are reconstructing an event, we talk in the book about, high school graduation as an example. And so you're grabbing building blocks of your high school and your friends in this moment of graduation. But then you may also have building blocks that are in your memory stores because someone else was talking about their high school graduation, or you imagined how great it would have been if you'd been able to have this conversation with someone, right? And so all of that content may be in your mind, and it's very easy to grab those building blocks and to actually put them together and to assemble a memory that has some features that are perhaps quite accurate, but other features that may be embellishments, that may be additions, that may be distorted in either important or unimportant ways, but it's because every time that we're retrieving that memory, we're having to reassemble it and we're having to piece back together those different, again, neural connections is what's happening in the brain, across the brain, and using the hippocampus to bind all of those together.
We are talking with the authors of Why We Forget and How to Remember Better, The Science Behind Memory. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you'd like to join the conversation this morning, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Dr. Andrew Budson, Chief of Cognitive and Behavioral Neurology at the Veterans Affairs Boston Healthcare System, Professor of Neurology at Boston University, and Elizabeth Kenzinger, Professor and Chair of the Department of Psychology and Neuroscience at Boston College. They are the authors of Why We Forget and How to Remember Better, The Science Behind Memory. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Okay, so how does the brain determine which memories to keep? We can't keep it all. So how does it say, okay, I'm going to keep this one and not that one?
So the brain is able to capitalize on a lot of prioritization cues that we can give it in the moment that we're experiencing an event. So one very strong prioritization cue is this event eliciting emotion? Are my palms sweating? Is my heart racing? Am I feeling joy? All of those are actually signals to the brain that this is an important moment. And so these building blocks should actually, there should be blueprints for how to reassemble this moment later so that you can re-access it. But there are other ways that we can give the brain prioritization cues as well. And in the book, we use the acronym FOUR, F-O-U-R, as a way, kind of a reminder of what those ways to give prioritization cues can be. And the F stands for focus attention. So going back to this idea, we can't multitask. Don't be trying to do two things at once. If you want to remember something, focus on that thing. Invest effort in trying to remember that thing. And then the way to invest that effort is really the O, U, and the R parts. So make sure the information is organized. We give an example in the book that if you're trying to remember a random string of words, it's really hard. If you can put those words into a sentence that makes sense, it's very easy to remember the same number of words. You have to organize it first. You also have to understand it, right? You have that sentence is organized, but you don't know what it means. It's not going to help. You have to think about the meaning of the information in a real world experience, right? You have to understand what is actually happening in this dialogue that I'm having with someone. If you don't have that understanding, you're not going to have a good memory of what happened in that conversation. And then you really want to invest effort to relate it to something that you already know or to something that's meaningful for you. And I think that relate step is particularly helpful with face and name pairings. So if you're meeting someone new and you're trying to remember their name, see if there's some connection you can make to something you already know. You know, do they share a name with someone, whether it's someone you know personally or your favorite author? Do their initials line up with something you already know? You know, try to make those connections. And it's both those specific principles of focusing attention, organizing, understanding, and relating. But more generally, it's just that you're spending time thinking about the material and investing the effort. And those are all prioritization cues that the brain uses to say, okay, this is a moment that is important to be recorded. Let me get those blueprints written and stored in the hippocampus so that later on you have the guide for how to reassemble that memory and get that content back. Yeah.
Although it doesn't last forever, some of those, right? Because you do this, you memorize something, and then, you know, like 5 years later, you go, oh, I did really well on that 5 years ago, but now it's moved to the back somewhere. But, you know, you talked about the words, and there's a little, like, section in the book there where you, I think it was 25 words, and then you go, okay, now don't look back. How many of those words can you, I wrote down, I think, 7 or 8. 2 of them were words that were not on the list. Right? Associations with whatever those words were. So it's interesting. And 7 is kind of, is an important number, right? I mean, phone numbers are 7. So what's the significance of 7?
So phone numbers are 7 digits because it's easy for us to remember it. What's actually interesting is, you know, when I took my freshman psychology class, I was taught that, in fact, the reason that 7 is the right number is in your working memory, you can remember 7 pieces of information plus or minus 2. But it turns out that later research has actually explained that the reason that 7 plus or minus 2 is a good number is we automatically chunk numbers into smaller units. And so it really is the number 4 that is this most special number. That is felt to be the number of units that we can actually keep in our working memory. And the reason that, like, phone numbers, you know, which nowadays are 10 digits long, are chunked into 3 numbers, 3 numbers, and 4 numbers is because our ability to chunk the numbers helps us to remember it. And we can remember 4 chunks of information in our head at any one time.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk a little bit about, we think about memory, we think about the past, but the memory's impact on the future. I think one of the first things I wrote down in the book was memory isn't just about recalling the past. It also plays a crucial role in allowing us to imagine and plan for the future.
This is one of the most important discoveries or understandings about memory that's come about in the recent past, because you're right that it's so easy to think about memory as, of course, being a record of what happened to us in the past. And then also to really question then, why is memory so subject to distortions? Why does it fade? Why do we not remember all of the specifics? And I think this reframing of the goal of memory really being about helping us to understand the present moment and helping us to make good predictions about the future helps to make all of this make so much more sense. Because then, of course, the specific details of what happened, especially 10, 15, 20 years ago, probably aren't going to be that useful for making a prediction about what's going to happen tomorrow or the next year. But the gist of what happened, the general ideas, are going to be extremely important for helping us to make predictions about the future. In the book, we talk about the example of deciding how much time you need to leave to go to the airport. It would be really inefficient to go back through your memory stores for every detail of every past airport you've been in. What was the departing gate of your airline? You know, what were the flight attendants' uniforms looking like, right? Those details aren't relevant, but it's extremely efficient for you to quickly be able to create a schema, a sense of a general airport, and to use that to help you figure out how much time you need to plan in order to make your flight before it departs. And so it seems like our memory systems really are optimally designed. They shed those irrelevant details that aren't going to help us make predictions about the future, but they keep a hold of for us of that kind of more general content that we can then quickly access and quickly integrate to be able to make good predictions.
Go ahead.
And one of the things that one of the reasons I feel that this is just so helpful and so important, a discovery or an understanding of how our memory works, is, you know, people are always coming up to me, you know, saying, you know, Andrew, you know, I'm concerned about my memory. You know, I'm having trouble remembering this, or I remember that wrong. And, you know, and the reason that people are often concerned about their memories, particularly as they're getting older, is that they're having a little forgetting or they're having some distortions. And it's all based on the fact that they assume that normal memory means you remember everything perfectly. Mm-hmm. And now that I can explain to them, well, in fact, it's normal to forget things. It's normal if a little, you know, distortion or a false memory or a mixed up memory happens. So I think it's, you know, it's not only is it helpful for understanding how memory works, but I think it can be very reassuring for all those folks out there who are worried that because they can't remember everything verbatim, that there's something wrong. Right. So now you can know, oh, thank God, that's okay. I don't need to remember everything verbatim.
You know, I have a 99-year-old uncle who lives with us, and he has an amazing memory. He's lost his eyesight, and I'm amazed to hear him on the phone telling people his, you know, he knows his insurance numbers, he knows his credit card numbers, he knows how he can keep all of this. And he's just started to sort of forget words, and he's searching for a word. And I said, I am a lot younger than you, and I forget a lot more than you. At 99, to be able to have that capacity is just, to me, blows my mind. But there are so many possibilities of what causes memory loss, right? And you go into a lot of those in the book. There's, you know, brain injuries, there's disease, there's effects of medication that can impact memory. But talk a little bit about, you know, that the normal aging brain, what that looks like. And then if we have some other, you know, cause for memory loss, we're having that on top of it, right? So it's not like you one or the other, you get both.
I'm so glad that you mentioned that, because it is something that people often don't think about, which is that, you know, if one is, you know, God forbid, developing Alzheimer's disease, assuming they're developing it in old age, they have the changes that you see in normal aging, and then on top of that, the changes that you see with Alzheimer's. So one way to think about some of the different anatomy that's involved in remembering is to think about that we talked about this building analogy, that we're sort of making little structures. And the contractor who's actually organizing all of this is located in our frontal lobes, right behind our forehead. And that seems to be the part of the memory system that does suffer a little bit as they get older. And so some normal things that can happen as people get older is that information may need to be repeated a couple of times in order to get a hold of it. It may take a little bit longer to retrieve information, may take an extra minute or two. And sometimes the older individual needs a hint or a cue in order to get the information into their memory store. And the important thing is that with normal memory, even in an older adult, once the information gets into the memory store, it can be retrieved, even if it takes time or you need a hint or a cue in order to pull it out. And that is contrasted with Alzheimer's disease, where perhaps in addition to some of those problems, there's also what we call a rapid rate of forgetting. And what we mean by that is, even when the information is repeated, even when you wait a bit of time or you give a hint or a cue, the information cannot be retrieved, because in general, the hippocampus or a related structure now has damage to it. And the hippocampus is that same structure that was removed in Henry and that we've learned is absolutely critical for forming those new episodic memories, memories for new episodes of our life.
What is a false memory? Talk about false memory.
So a false memory is really an error in that building process. Usually it's that blocks have been included that shouldn't be there. Sometimes they come from a related event. So it could be that we've actually merged two experiences. And so we've rebuilt something that isn't quite right for either of those events, but that does have pieces of both of them. There's a study that we talk about where they a lab showed individuals photographs that had been doctored to make it look like someone had taken a hot air balloon ride. And that, you know, that's an example of a false memory that was probably created in part by people pulling elements of things that had happened. They'd maybe seen a hot air balloon somewhere else. They'd been up high, perhaps in a skyscraper rather than in an air balloon, right? And then they were merging those building blocks and actually were able to create an entirely false memory about something that they had never experienced. That's an extreme example, but it happens all the time that we have memories that are distorted in more subtle ways. We think that we ate at a particular restaurant before when we've only walked by it and imagined what it would be like to eat there. We think that there were people at a dinner with us when people weren't there. Perhaps we had some other conversation with them in a different context. And again, that's often about grabbing the wrong building blocks and assembling a structure. Mm-hmm. It's also because, as we mentioned, that memory is not about remembering verbatim every detail that happened. And so sometimes we also have false memories because something is very consistent with the gist, the general theme of what happened. Something similar happened. And so we're very willing to just accept that this other related event must have also taken place. So I think those are the most common reasons why we have false memories. And it's really important to recognize that they're just properties of a healthy, well-functioning memory system that is doing what it is designed to do, which is not about retaining those very specific details. It's about remembering the more general content that's useful for us now and in the future.
It's another little tidbit that I thought was fascinating. You write, individuals who lie, saying that erroneous details occurred during an event, can come to believe that those details really happened. That was sort of eye-opening to me because I thought, wow, that explains how some people are just so convincing with their lies that you go, oh, and because they believe it.
But I think it's important to recognize once you've built that structure that has those erroneous building blocks, that is now a representation that exists in your brain. And you're actually going to very likely store the blueprints for how to rebuild that. And so, you know, if you lie and you're telling the story about how something happened, you're actually creating a representation of that kind of alternate reality. But now there is going to be a blueprint, and it's very easy in the future to believe that that's the blueprint that you need to use to reassemble what actually happened in the past.
So we're talking about sort of recreating and false memory, which kind of explains why sometimes we can question eyewitness testimony in a courtroom. Physical evidence seems to be better than eyewitness testimony.
Yeah, well, you know, often eyewitness testimony, especially when we're talking about facial recognition, identification, you know, it's one of the obviously extremely important uses of memory, but it really starts to push the bounds of what the human memory system was designed to do. Recognizing which particular person you saw, often, you know, briefly and in a stressful context, is all about the details. You know, every face has two eyes, a nose, and a mouth. It's not useful to have that information going in to identify the person. It's all about very specific and small differences in the details of those configurations of those features. And as we've just talked about, that is just not what memory is designed to be good at holding on to. So, I think it is not surprising that there are many instances where people find that task extremely difficult to do, even if some of those prioritization cues were present at the time where the experience was happening, where the brain is getting the right information, that this information is important, you know, store this. It's just not the level of resolution that our brain is naturally designed to be holding on to. Yeah. And so again, it's really just pushing the limits of what our memory system is able to do.
We're talking with the authors of Why We Forget and How to Remember Better, The Science Behind Memory. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are discussing memory and the book Why We Forget and How to Remember Better, the science behind memory. And with us is Dr. Andrew Budson, Chief of Cognitive and Behavioral Neurology at the Veterans Affairs Boston Healthcare System and Professor of Neurology at Boston University, and Elizabeth Kensinger, Professor and Chair of the Department of Psychology and Neuroscience at Boston College. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Andrew, you want to add something from before the break?
Yes, just one of the things that I think is particularly interesting that I found fascinating when I first learned about it is that every time we retrieve a memory, we actually re-encode it or relearn it. And so it is one of the reasons that errors can creep into our memory so easily is that we're always sort of restoring the memory. So we call it like a memory cycle, because you learn it, you store it, you retrieve it, and once you retrieve it, you restore it. And so something that frequently happens to me is if I watch a movie with one person and then I watch the movie again with somebody else, I'll often combine those memories and think that I saw them with both people together.
That is interesting.
So very easy for these false memories to creep in.
Yeah. Talk a little about PTSD and trauma that can produce a memory that you can't forget no matter how much you would like to, right? So that can be, I mean, really tough for folks who've been through some traumatic event.
Absolutely. So, you know, in some ways, PTSD is the flip side of, you know, for many of us, we wish that we could remember more. And for many individuals with PTSD, they really wish that there was something that they could forget and could have that memory not be so intrusive. And it's really that intrusive nature of the memory that is so characteristic of memories in individuals that are experiencing PTSD. It's not just that they're remembering this past moment, it's that when it comes back, it's a consuming memory. It comes back at unwanted times when they don't want to be thinking about it. And it's very difficult to be able to push that memory out of mind. And those are really the characteristics that make those memories so different from typical episodic memories, where often when the memory comes back, if it's not the right moment, if it's not relevant, it's easy for us to momentarily push it to the side, to discard it, to go on to think about something that's more helpful to us in the moment. Individuals with PTSD don't experience that same control over when they're rebuilding that memory. We talked about the prefrontal cortex being the contractor that's orchestrating that building process. And it's as if in PTSD, that contractor just isn't paying attention to what's going on. And so something is being built where it shouldn't be. And now is not the right moment, but it's going ahead and it's building that. And it's not getting disassembled when it should be disassembled. So something is really going, that is really affected in terms of the when those memories are being built. And again, when those memories are being disassembled and put away.
What about the opposite? We, you know, there are folks who go through a trauma and they have no recollection at all. They don't remember it at all. What's happening there? I mean, somehow they're able to purposely block it out. Is it just so painful? I mean, what's happening?
That may be about the way that memories were, or in that case, were not created as the event was being experienced. So there is some evidence to suggest that stress at different levels can have different impacts on our likelihood to be able to form a memory in a way that is going to be able to be stored. And at extreme levels of stress, it may be that actually the systems that are involved, the hippocampus in particular, may not be functioning efficiently enough to be able to store a memory that's going to be accessible in those consciously accessible ways. Mm. So it doesn't necessarily mean that people aren't going to have any changes in their behavior as a result of that stressful event. It could be that some of these other memory systems that we talked about that don't depend on the hippocampus do actually have some record of that event, but the individual may not have conscious access to that event because at the time, the hippocampus was sort of overwhelmed by these stress hormones. The hippocampus is extremely sensitive to cortisol and other stress hormones. And so it just might not have been able to act efficiently to store that memory.
Let's talk about savants for a second. I mean, sometimes you have, and this we find this a lot in some higher functioning people with autism, right? They you go, how do they know, retain all this information? And so what's happening there? Is it a particular area of the brain that they're able to access that the rest of us are not? What's happening?
Well, here we thought it was fascinating to discover that, you know, many savants actually are capitalizing on a tremendous amount of scaffolding that they have built up around things, for instance, calendar savants that can tell you exactly what day and date, you know, correspond to many years ago and to events on different dates. Often what they've actually done is built up a tremendously strong scaffolding around the calendar system. They may have spent a lot of time actually understanding the different cyclical nature of, you know, months and years, and knowing, being able to then on the kind of spontaneously use this information to be able to generate those answers. And so for them, it's actually more a working memory system that is highly engaged in solving those sorts of problems based on the semantic knowledge, the factual knowledge that they've built up over time.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting too, that there is no such thing as a photographic memory, yet we have people who seem to remember everything. I think I saw something on 60 Minutes once with actress Mary Lou Henner, right? Who can remember everything. That just seems impossible. Are they really remembering everything?
Well, I think it's yes and no. So the important distinction is that these individuals who have something referred to as highly superior autobiographical memory, the autobiographical in that clause is really important there, because what that means is they remember everything that happened to them. But actually, if you show those individuals a random set of unrelated words or other types of content, their memory isn't highly superior in the same way. So it's very different than this concept of photographic memory, which again, does not actually exist in the way that most of us colloquially use that term, which would mean that anything that you show someone, no matter how meaningless, no matter how much content is there, that someone can just effortlessly remember it. That isn't something that exists. And even for these people with highly superior autobiographical memory, it's not extending to the minutia of anything that's meaningless, that's not kind of unfolding in a meaningful way in their own life.
Mm. All right. So let's talk about some of the things we need to think about if we want to improve our memory. What, diet, exercise. So first, let's talk about the benefits of exercise.
Yeah, exercise, you know, I introduced that chapter by we talk about it as the sort of the elixir of life. Exercise really is amazingly powerful. It releases growth factors in the brain that helps us to grow new brain cells, to increase the connections between brain cells. And, you know, for all your listeners out there, like you want to do one thing to take away and improve your memory, it would be to, you know, engage in a regular aerobic exercise. The recommendations are at least 30 minutes a day, at least 5 days a week. It's so important.
Another big one is sleep.
Yes. So we in the medical scientific community now understand that sleep is absolutely critical for memory in a whole bunch of different ways. And one of the most fascinating things that I have discovered as a memory clinician and researcher is that I think we now are beginning to get a good handle on what dreams are and how dreams are related to the memory process. It is, I'm going to use the words, it is highly likely that, you know, when we are in non-REM sleep, we still can have dreams. And those dreams are actually replaying what we did over the last day, or maybe even the last couple of days or weeks or months, and helping us to put that memory down in a more permanent store so that we're going to remember that information later. And then during the REM sleep, the sort of crazy dream sleep when our eyes are rapidly moving, it seems like we're connecting that memory that happened recently to everything else that we know, to our factual knowledge, to other autobiographical memories. So we're now understanding that at least a big part of sleep, what the brain is doing, it's actually totally involved in forming these memories. And this is one of the reasons that if one crams for a test, and instead of learning a little bit each day across the semester, you know, if you try and learn it all like the night or two before the exam, you might remember it for the exam, but it won't get incorporated into long-term memory. And that's why information that is crammed is typically forgotten a couple weeks later, whereas information that's learned a little bit each day can be remembered for a lifetime.
So it makes sense then why, you know, sometimes we'll have some sort of dilemma, something we're contemplating, like, what am I going to do about X? And then all of a sudden you wake up in the middle of the night and you go, aha, I've got it. Because here's your memory. They're all kind of, as you say, consolidating your memories and putting it in order. And you go, there's the answer right there.
Absolutely. It's really fascinating that, you know, we all automatically sort of, you know, process information, process memories, even process problems while we're sleeping. And I think we've all had the experience at least a couple of times where you wake up and you understand the answer to your problem better. And we're now much closer to understanding exactly what's going on when this is happening.
Good idea to keep a notebook next to the bed so you can jot this stuff down. And then diet. Diet is also very important.
Yeah, it's important to eat healthy foods. I think the most succinct way that I could put it right now is that we want to eat foods that are not heavily processed. That seems to be one of the keys. And if we're eating sort of whole foods and in moderation, such that, you know, we're maintaining a healthy body weight along with exercise, that is really key as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you had to give sort of a palette of foods, it would be the Mediterranean menu of foods that's been the most highly studied. But there's actually some more recent evidence that, you know, as long as the foods are sort of close to their natural state, are not highly processed, and you're eating them in moderation, that's probably the most important things. I wouldn't tell people they can't eat any particular food once in a while. Just keep it in moderation. Try not to eat processed foods.
Yeah. And all of this makes so much sense of why mindfulness is helpful, right? Because you're focusing, which is something you said earlier, if you can focus. So being able to use mindfulness is also helpful.
Absolutely. I think so many of the memory frustrations that we have come from not paying attention to what's happening in the moment. You set your keys down and weren't paying attention. And so now you don't know where they are when you're looking for them later. And so I think being able to train ourselves to really be mindful in the moment, it helps us avoid those frustrations. It also helps us to really be able to get into our memories those moments, those small moments that can actually bring us joy later on, to be able to remember them, you know, whether it's just how beautiful the fall in New England looked, whatever those small moments might be. If we're mindful of them, we're focusing, those are actually going to get represented in our memories, and we're later going to go back and be able to re-experience those small moments and again get joy from re-experiencing them.
Just about a minute left, and I wonder your thoughts on positive thinking. I'm a big believer in positive thinking, but what do you think?
Well, I will say it's been studied, and people who have a positive attitude do better as they age in terms of their cognitive brain health. And it's believed to work for all the obvious reasons. People of a positive attitude are more likely to take care of themselves, eat right, and exercise. People who have a positive attitude are also more likely to be outgoing and social. And that's another thing that has been shown to be important for your thinking and memory as you age.
The book is Why We Forget and How to Remember Better, The Science Behind Memory. We'll have a link with more information at our website, capeandislands.org. Dr. Andrew Budson, Chief of Cognitive and Behavioral Neurology at the Veterans Affairs Boston Healthcare System and Professor of Neurology at Boston University. Elizabeth Kenzinger, Professor and Chair of the Department of Psychology and Neuroscience at Boston College. Thank you both. What fascinating read with lots of helpful information. Really appreciate you sharing it with us.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thanks so much.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.